Hello and welcome to In Conservation With. As always, I'm your host, Chris Shine. On this week's podcast, I am delighted to be joined in the studio by Becca Marsh. Hi, Becca.
Hi.
So can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of your degree and other stuff like that?
Hi, I'm Becca. I'm a third year environmental biology student at the University of Nottingham, and I'm the president of Conservation Society.
So we'll crack straight in. Our first question is regards to your early memories, and what is your first memory of kind of wildlife in the UK?
I would have to say it stems back to probably my grandparents. And have you heard of the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust down in Slimbridge?
That's my local one, yeah.
And mine, actually. Yeah, so my grandparents, I used to demand to be taken there every weekend. It was my favourite place to go. Loved feeding all the Canadian geese and everything. So that's where it all stemmed from originally.
So when you kind of went to Slimbridge when you were younger, was it more kind of focused on the hides and seeing the birds, or more the kind of getting the seeds and feeding them?
When I was younger, it was definitely just feeding the birds, but as I've grown older, I've learned to enjoy the hides a lot more.
Did you ever feed a swan?
No, I haven't committed to that one yet.
Fab. Okay, so secondly is, what is your favourite wildlife sighting?
My favourite one, it'd have to be when I was scuba diving in Mauritius, and me and my dad were with this group of about six of us, and suddenly the guide disappeared off following two eagle rays, which were disappearing into the distance, swimming at full pout, and then suddenly me and my dad both looked down, and there was this huge 2 meter stingray just sat underneath the rock right next to us, and we're like, why are you following them? There's this huge stingray. Where are you going?
Do you get to scuba dive much, or?
I call myself a fair weather scuba diver, so only if it's warm and good weather, so not choppy seas.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Okay, so moving on, where is your favourite place to see wildlife?
Probably quite a controversial one. I love seeing wildlife in cities because I think it really shows that wildlife is absolutely everywhere. So just last night I was on campus and I saw a badger run across the road in front of me, and I just absolutely adore just seeing snippets of wildlife wherever I am. So you suddenly look up and there's a bird of prey above you, just normal everyday life. That's my favourite place.
Yeah, and I think I kind of touched on it in the last podcast, but it's kind of, people don't appreciate how much wildlife we do have in and around us, and kind of, you don't need to go and spend thousands of pounds to go out to these remote places. So like, what was it, we talked about urban foxes last week and things like that kind of just live in and amongst us, and a lot of people maybe don't realise.
Yeah, I think it's really underrated how much wildlife is around us. Like, I did a summer placement and I was looking at doing the surveying of species, and the amount of bats and badgers and everything that's amongst us is absolutely phenomenal. You just don't realise it.
So where did you do that kind of placement with?
It was with a company called ACOM.
Okay.
So it's an ecological consultancy.
And was that rewarding? Would you recommend something like that to kind of other people?
Highly recommend it. Absolutely loved it. And it's really nice. I'm quite an outdoorsy person, so not being stuck in the office 24/7 was really good.
Okay, so can you, so kind of following on from that, can you tell me a little bit more about maybe some conservation projects you've been involved with?
So, as part of my degree, I was really lucky and I did a tropical biodiversity field course over in Malaysia, which I would definitely recommend if anyone gets the chance. And as part of that, we were on Tioman Island. And whilst we were out there, they've got what's called the Jawara Turtle Project.
Easy to say.
Yeah. And so about, what was it, 1 o'clock in the morning, me and a few friends were patrolling the beaches to see if any turtles had turned up and laid eggs and things like that. And then they fenced them all off to make sure that they're not affected by predators. And then we used to be able to watch them hatch, and just loads of little baby turtles going towards the sea. It was absolutely amazing. So that was a definite highlight. But then, a bit closer to home, I volunteer in the Peak District.
Oh, nice.
With the Peak Park Conservation Volunteers. Another easy one to say. So we do things like controlling species like silver birch, and we cut down brash and burn it, and apparently make jacket potatoes on the burning brash, which is always lovely. We've built footpaths as well.
Oh, nice.
So the regular hikers can use them. So that's really, really rewarding. And I'm actually going there this weekend.
Oh, nice. So if your experiences are a lot more than, say, protecting specific species, it's more finding ways to enable a wide range of wildlife to thrive.
Yeah, I think maybe controversial, but I think it's quite a narrow-minded view to just try and preserve one species when we could save a habitat and save lots of species. So I'm going for the bigger picture.
Yes. Okay, so lastly, I'm sure there's many people who have been really interested by the projects you've talked about and kind of your experiences. So for students of the University of Nottingham who may want to get involved in things that are similar to this, what's the best way for them to do it?
I would thoroughly recommend, maybe biased, but Conservation Society. So we do loads of outdoor projects. So we meet every Wednesday, and so we do bird walks and tree walks, and we do practical conservation work as well, like round Highfields Lake, working with the park rangers. And like I said, this weekend I'm volunteering with them in the Peak District, so you can do weekends away, which are also great. But we've also got our own community garden allotment, so you can do a bit of gardening, grow some your own veg. So we do loads of little things, and we're just trying to do our little bit to help. So we do habitat conservation in our little garden as well, just the little bits we can which seem achievable.
Yes. So last week we talked about the Nottinghamshire Wildlife Trust and some of their kind of reserves that they've got up and around the county. So have you been fortunate to go to Attenborough Nature Reserve?
I have, yes.
And can you kind of... I tried to give a portrayal of it last week, having not had the opportunity to go yet. So can you tell us a little bit more about what to expect?
It is amazing, because it's in the middle of Beeston Chilwell, and you don't expect it, and it's just this huge lake, and the amount of wildlife is just... It's one of those places you're not... It's like a hidden gem amongst Nottingham. So it's just species galore, really.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us this week. It's been really informative.
Fab, thank you.
So this next section focuses on wildlife in popular culture. And this week, it's hard not to talk about the show that returned to BBC One on Sunday night, Blue Planet 2.
Usually, they are solitary hunters. But about 50 of them have come here from neighbouring reefs, attracted by this abundance of potential prey.
This show has been 4 years in the making, and once again has David Attenborough to narrate it. There'll be 7 episodes in the series, and we're kind of hoping to have a little section on each episode to talk a little bit about what's gone on and kind of relate it to other news in wildlife. For those of you who missed it or want to watch us on the iPlayer, and if you want to watch it live, it's Sunday at 8 p.m. The first episode focused on oceans, and the first kind of species featured was one we talked about briefly last week at the end of the podcast, and that is bottlenose dolphins. It was a really nice scene, this one, focusing on the kind of bottlenose dolphins in the Red Sea, and they showed them surfing just for the sheer joy of surfing. They expanded later on in the episode and saying how this sort of behaviour helps them socially, helps them make friends and kind of get on and interact with the other dolphins in their pod. They also showed a really nice feature with the Gorgonian coral, I think I've pronounced that correctly, where you saw them swimming through the water and the adults would deliberately rub themselves against the fronds of the coral. And although rather reluctant at first, the babies, what do you call baby dolphins? I'm sure someone can help me out with that one. They would soon follow. And kind of research by scientists has shown that the fronds of the Gorgonian coral have anti-inflammatory properties, so may help protect the dolphins against disease and infection. And whilst this show's ingenious on the part of the dolphins, it's also kind of given us a lesson, and we are now using these sort of resources and looking at these sort of areas to help inform human medicine and stuff that can maybe save lives, kind of from our point of view. So that was dolphins, which I kind of wanted to talk about just to relate it back to last week's podcast. But the main focus for me that I took from Blue Planet 2 was so-called fish intelligence, which was mentioned a number of times. So initially this was on behalf of the tuskfish, who are found predominant in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. And they travelled to the edge of their reef to hunt for clams. And once they've got the clam, they swim back in and they use a kind of a rough piece of rock to crack open the clam. They don't have hands, they don't have opposable thumbs, so this isn't the easiest thing in the world to do, but eventually they manage to crack it open and they have the nice juicy food from inside the clam. And this is changing our understanding of fish intelligence, because previously it's thought that the use of tools is a sign only really found in humans and other great apes and maybe certain other species. So the fact that a fish that has a lot smaller brain than a human and a lot less complex brain is able to do this kind of changes the way we think about how intelligent fish are. Maybe we've underestimated their abilities. To take this further, we saw the giant trevelis in the Indian Ocean, who, in my opinion, they were both beautiful and horrifying at the same time. And there are those great images, or depending on whose side you're on, of them jumping out of the water to take the juvenile turns from either the surface of the water or even in low flight. And to be able to do this, they've had to calculate the airspeed of the birds, the trajectory of the birds, and the altitudes of the birds. So again, this is a highly complex skill that these fish have been able to acquire and achieve, whether through evolution or through learning. I think that's something that's yet to be discovered. Other signs of fish intelligence in the research, you can kind of look at some species of reef fish have been shown to be able to use ultraviolet patterns for covert facial recognition in humans, and they've used these ultraviolet patterns in other objects, so for between species recognition. So this is kind of another sign that they may be a lot more intelligent than we've previously given them credit for. Similarly, carp that have been captured by anglers have been shown to be less catchable after this point. So again, it appears that they've learned from the memory of the negative experience and so adopt behaviours to stop them being caught again. So that kind of summarises what I took from Blue Planet 2. And as I said, we'll have more on this in the next podcast of next week's episode. The other thing I wanted to talk about was kind of to start introducing some films and other forms of media that I would like to recommend people to go and see that kind of portray wildlife in one way or another. And the first of these is a film called The Big Year.
There's going to be major fallout in a few hours.
Nuclear fallout?
Bird fallout.
It stars Steve Martin, Owen Wilson of Night of the Museum fame, Jack Black from probably School of Rock is the film I most know him from. And they compete in a bird watching challenge in America where you have to see how many species of birds you can spot in one calendar year. And it's a really highly competitive event. It's a film, so they have other aspects of their personal lives which interfere, and it kind of details that as well. But It's just a really good film to introduce people to how much fun can be had bird watching. And whilst it's not UK wildlife, it's American wildlife, it is still a really good watch. And the storyline, whilst not spectacular, is bearable as long as you enjoy the wildlife. And this sort of thing is done in real life, and it's done in the UK as well, in the British Ornithological Union. They run a competition each year, and last year, 2016, the record was broken by a chap called Mark from Derbyshire. Unfortunately, I couldn't get any more details than that. And he surpassed the 400 mark, which had not previously been done. So he saw 400 species of bird in the UK in one calendar year. So bearing in mind there's supposedly only 420 that are seen by anyone in the calendar year, to see 400 of them is quite spectacular. And these include species like the red-footed booby and the Siberian thrush, which were hardly in the UK for any time at all. So to see 400 is spectacular. A similar but not quite the same concept, which is more accessible to the kind of average person, is the Big Garden Bird Watch. And I think registration for this starts mid-December. And the premise is that in one weekend in January, you just spend 1 hour of your weekend, Saturday or Sunday, sat in your garden, and you make a note of every bird you see. So you note species and numbers. And then what happens is you send this data into the RSPB, and they collate it from all over the country, and they can kind of get an understanding of how various species are doing. The last section of the podcast, as always, is Well I Never, a section that focuses on species of wildlife that you may not expect to see in the UK. The species we're going to focus on this week is a species more synonymous with Australia and Africa and the Amazon, and is one of the most common phobias in the UK, and that is, of course, the snake. Now, in the UK, we have three native species of snake. They are the grass snake, the smooth snake, and the adder. And I'm just briefly going to go through where you can find them, if indeed you want to find them, and kind of the markings that you can use to help distinguish one from the other. So the grass snake is our most common snake, and it's common to both England and Wales and Scotland. And it's often found near water in heathland and meadows, or you can often find it swimming in rivers and pools and marshes. And it's kind of characterised by, it's the longest snake in the UK, and it can grow up to beyond 1 metre. The colours, it varies, but it's predominantly between grey-green and dark olive colour, and it's very distinguishable by a yellow and black collar around its neck. The second species is the smooth snake. Now, the smooth snake is incredibly rare in England, and it's actually restricted to certain heathlands in Dorset, Hampshire and Surrey. So unless you live in these counties, you're very unlikely to see a smooth snake. But if you wanted to identify it, then it's a slender snake, and it kind of grows to approximately 70 centimetres. The males are brown and the females are grey. It's got a dark butterfly shape on top of its head, and then it has black bars that run down its back. If you do see one, I would advise precaution. It can bite, and it does bite, and it will draw blood almost certainly, but it's not venomous, so you shouldn't need to be rushed to hospital, although it's probably best anyway. And then lastly is maybe the most famous of the British snakes, the adder. The adder is widely distributed throughout the country, and it lives in specific habitats such as heathland, moorland and open meadows. It's quite a stocky snake, but again, it's similar in length to the smooth snake, and is approximately 70 centimetres. Males are a grey colour with black zigzags along their back, whereas females are a brown colour with dark brown zigzags along their back. Often you can distinguish it from other snakes by a V or an X-shaped marking on the head, and then a row of dark spots along each side. So kind of the key things to take away from that is I wouldn't actively go looking for snakes. That's probably not the best idea. The two ones you're most likely to see are the adder and the grass snake. The grass snake is longer than a metre, the adder snake is a lot smaller, nearer to 70 centimetres, and a kind of further easy distinguishing marker to look for is this yellow and black collar around the neck, which is found on the grass snake. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. If you haven't already, like us on Facebook, In Conservation with URN, where I'll post all the links to everything I've discussed in this week's podcast. So if there's anything that kind of got you particularly interested, then you can look on there. I'll also post the link to Conservation Society's page if you're an awesome uni student, so you can get involved with the bird walks and various stuff that they offer. And you can also just comment on there, comment on the post when it goes out. It'll be Friday. You can comment any comments you've got on the show, any feedback, anything you'd want to see covered next week, any films you want to recommend, any music albums you want to recommend, any literally anything. If you post it on there, and I'll try and reply, and I'll try and find a way to get involved in the show. So until the next podcast, goodbye.